Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Michael Kellett. He's executive director of the New England nonprofit organization Restore the North Woods, which he co-founded in 1992. He's been involved in national park, wilderness, public land, and endangered species issues for more than 30 years. In 1994, he developed a proposal for a 3.2 million acre Maine Woods National Park, which laid the groundwork for the 2016 designation by President Obama of Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument. In Massachusetts, he has worked to protect Walden Woods and Henry David Thoreau's birthplace and helped to develop legislation introduced in 2019, which would protect state conservation lands from logging and other development. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So back in the mid-90s, I interviewed Robert J. Lifton, who's probably the world's foremost authority on the psychology of genocide. And one of the things he said that has influenced my work more than probably anything else anybody else has ever said is that before you can commit an atrocity, you have to have what he called a claim to virtue. You have to claim that what you're doing is in fact helpful and not harmful.
Right.
And about that same time, I was asked by a local alternative newspaper to write about something the Forest Service was calling a forest health initiative, which the local newspaper guy said, you know, who could argue against trying to make the forest a healthier place? And I went to write my article about it, and all of a sudden I understood the Forest Service arguments, because it felt like they were doing what Robert J. Lifton said of this claims to virtue, that it was insane to say you can log a forest to better health, and that's what they were doing. So you seem like the perfect person in the world to talk to about the history of Forest Service, the history of either Forest Service claims to virtue on logging, or to put in a more value neutral sense, the history of the reasons that the Forest Service has given over the last, let's say, 80 to 100 years for why they need to deforest in the national forest.
Right.
So that's it. That's the question.
Sure. It started out, the U.S. Forest Service was really a progressive idea at the beginning. It was, Gifford Pinchot and these emerging professional foresters looked around and they saw that there was just widespread, unmitigated slashing and clearing of forests with no thought at all about the future, and just total destruction. And, in those days, they weren't thinking about ecosystems or whatever, but they thought, oh, this is just wasteful, and it's going to, we're going to cut down all the trees. We won't have any left. We need timber. So in the early, the beginning of the Forest Service and forestry was really a progressive thing relative to total destruction. So they proceeded to, and they believed in multiple use. They weren't into wilderness or whatever. They thought you should use forests. You should just not totally destroy them in the process. So that model proceeded for decades.
And the cut was pretty small, right?
Sorry?
And the cut was pretty small at that point,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, for one thing, there still was a lot of private timberland, so they were still liquidating private timber. So there wasn't as much demand on the public forest. And the guys who were overseeing the national forests really believed that they should be, fairly light touch compared with the stuff they were seeing on the private lands. They thought that was really bad. So they were really trying to be reasonable and be sustainable and so forth. And that was, Gifford Pinchot's idea was, the long-term thinking was what he was into. And although I don't agree with him on a lot of things, I think if they had stuck with his model, we'd be a lot better off. But what happened is World War II really shifted a lot of things, because all of a sudden it created a an excuse for unmitigated development of a lot of things, minerals and oil and gas, and one of the things was timber. And a good example of that, not in the national forest, but in the national park, was Olympic National Park. They were pushing to log old growth trees, Sitka spruce, in Olympic National Park during World War II, because they were saying, oh, we need the Sitka spruce for gliders, for our flyboys. Otherwise, we're going to lose the war. And to their credit, the Park Service wavered and allowed some of it, but then they basically pushed back. And actually, Franklin Roosevelt, Harold Ickes, the Secretary of the Interior, I believe, was the one who actually finally said, no way, this is stupid. But what it did is that it sort of shifted the thinking of how public forests were going to be run. And then after World War II, they basically went all out for full-scale timber development. And, you had the baby boom. You had all these guys coming back from the war who wanted to buy a house. And they were made of wood. And so the 1950s was the beginning of just full-scale timber production on the national forests. And they had, and the other part of it was they had all these mechanisms. They had all these more advanced machinery. In the old days, it was a chainsaw, or in the early days, axes and chainsaws. Well, but, you know, by the 1950s, they had much, much bigger mechanization. And they were building roads. The other thing is they didn't have very many roads in the early days. These were basically really backcountry wildland areas until World War II. And so they were building roads. They had this equipment. They had herbicides and pesticides. So they basically just ramped up into full industrial forestry production by the 1950s. And then it just got worse as they had more and more technology and more roads, until the 1980s was where it really reached a peak under Ronald Reagan. And they were just devastating the forests. And in the meantime, there was this parallel concept that old growth trees were decadent and over mature, and they were all going to fall down and die. So we needed to clear those out and replace them with thrifty plantations of fast growing, vigorous trees that we could turn into lumber. And that continued really until now, almost. Basically we had full scale timber production. And they didn't really even try to apologize for it. I mean, I remember working for the Wilderness Society in the late 1980s, and we raised all kinds of concerns about biodiversity, and climate was not a big issue then, but we talked about, water quality and watersheds and erosion and unsustainable production of timber, where you ended up with denuded landscapes, and how plantations were biologically sterile. And it didn't make any difference to the Forest Service. They didn't care. And it really wasn't until what happened is those messages, though. The other thing was below cost timber sales, of course. All this logging, probably not in the early days, but certainly since the 1960s, I'd say, except for old growth in the Pacific Northwest, which was profitable, and all the other logging pretty much was money losing. So they basically, the taxpayers were subsidizing the U.S. Forest Service to cut down our forests. And that was because the Forest Service thought it had to be cut down. You got to manage it. The mentality is everything needs to be managed. And I'll just say that's the heart of all of this ecological destruction that's going on, is the mentality that humans can and should and know how to manage nature better than nature. And so everything should be managed, and we know what we're doing. And uh, just let's just decide what we're going to do in this place, in that place, in that place. So anyway, what happened is the public, I believe, that's the problem for the Forest Service and their ilk now, is the public is catching on to a lot of this stuff. And the excuse of, well, we just need to produce timber for houses and, you know, we need more timber, more wood. That argument alone really doesn't work anymore for normal people, because they go, well, yeah, but what about climate change? What about water quality? What about wildlife? What about scenic beauty? What about places where I can take my kids for a hike and so forth? And so the Forest Service realized, well, we can't. OK, we're going to have responses to all these concerns. And so now they have a whole menu of excuses for logging that really don't, half the time they don't even really tell you they're doing it to produce timber. They just pretend it's for some other reason. Oh, yeah, by the way, there's timber that's produced on the side. Yeah, right. But that's just a side benefit of all this necessary management. And so there's a whole list of these excuses. And one of the things that I recently, as you know, delved into is co-wrote this paper on one of the major excuses, which is we need to clear and cut forests to make early successional young forest habitat for wildlife species. Because if we don't, a bunch of them are going to, they're declining and they're going to go extinct, and we don't have enough of this habitat anymore. And unless we create it, it's not going to be created anymore enough to help these species. And so that's a reason why we need to do management, which means cutting down trees. And as we found with in our paper, there are no species that we could find that need humans logging forests to survive and thrive. And the other part of it is there's plenty of this early successional young forest. Anybody who drives around can see all kinds of open areas and scruffy looking, you know, former farmland and so forth, and power line rights of way and freeway rights of way and you know, areas that have been blown down and had hurricanes and tornadoes and beaver dams flooded. So that's
keep going.
So that's in the eastern U.S. That's one of the biggest excuses for logging is creating habitat for, you know, young forest, grassland, early successional species. And well, just about every logging job that I've seen in the East nowadays, that's a big part of their rationale. So it's a big threat. And most people don't know about this excuse, or they think it sounds, you know, it sounds reasonable. Gee, they just want to save wildlife. Of course, who wouldn't want to save wildlife? So that's working pretty well. And then the other big excuse right now, aside, is the, of course, fire in the West mainly. And they have, there's this entire decades of proselytizing and propagandizing and mythology that the way to fight fires is to, you know, suppress it in some places, but then suppression actually is not a good idea. So then we have to log and thin the forest because we suppressed it before. We not only have to log it, but we have to burn because supposedly there were all these low intensity fires and now there's too much fuel left over from the suppression. So we have to cut and burn the fuel. That's really working well. So the U.S. Forest Service has been, and I think the BLM is part of this too, but they got $5 billion recently allocated for so-called fire programs, which is mainly just logging and some burning. And what happened, and it's great for them because it enables them to further their timber production goals, because there's all kinds of stuff that they can cut down and claim that it's to fight fire. It also furthers another goal, which is to promote the biomass industry, because at one point there was this whole, one of the excuses was we need to cut down and burn trees because that means we don't have to burn fossil fuels to make energy. And then that was shown to be actually worse than burning coal and totally not beneficial to the climate, but horrible for the climate. But now they can say, well, we have all this waste wood that we had to cut down for to fight fires. And what are we going to do with it? Well, let's burn it for biomass, and it'll be a win-win because then it's going to help the climate. And of course, in the meantime, you got these old guard guys who are still living in the 50s and who believe that the best answer to everything is a chainsaw or a feller buncher. And they claim vehemently that we have to thin the forests and burn millions and millions of acres. They're talking about tens of millions of acres in the West. They want to do this. And there's a growing foundation of scientific research that shows that actually logging makes fires worse. And areas that have not been logged have less fire, and the fires are less severe. Because when you log, you're opening up the forest to wind, and it dries out. The sun reaches it more readily. So you have this dry material. When you log, there's stuff left over. Even when they think they're clearing it out, there's still a bunch of slash left throughout the forest. So now we're learning that actually this whole concept of fighting fire by logging so-called controlled burns is the opposite of what we ought to be doing. The only place where it makes any sense at all is right near communities. If we, you know, where people have their houses, you do need to clear burnable stuff right around their houses so it doesn't jump. But going back in the backcountry, which is what most of it is, is basically zero benefit in terms of fire, protecting from fire. And it, of course, it costs a lot of money, but also, of course, it does incredible ecological damage. And also a lot of people have lost their lives doing it. So here you got people going out there with this useless, worse than useless strategy. But it's producing a lot of timber, which really is, in the end, that's really the top goal of these managers. That's really all they care about is getting the cutout. And so it's just another way to get the cutout.
Speaking of getting the cutout, I don't believe you've yet mentioned insects as an excuse.
No, well, that's another one, is forest health, as they call it. And that means insects and disease. It means other damage that can reduce the quality of timber. It's really about timber production. And so they claim they have to cut down a bunch of trees for insects and disease. And it's basically, you know, let's destroy the forest to save it. And of course, there's research that shows that actually when forests that have had insect, most of the insects and disease stuff are native, natural disturbances that have happened for millennia perfectly normally. They just happen and it kills trees, but all the trees don't die. And in fact, what it does is it actually thins out the forest, as they claim is beneficial. Well, actually it thins it enough that it reduces the intensity of fire on those lands. So actually they go in then and cut all these trees down, and then they create the really open type area, which actually is more flammable. So that's another excuse. And the other thing that has been learned with research, I mean, these guys, they're really just like a bull in the china shop. They don't know what they have no understanding of ecosystems. Nobody does. None of us really understand ecosystems. they're way too complex. And it's not like they go out and do a survey of 100% of the species occupying their future timber sale, and they go, oh, okay, what's going to be the impact on this bacterium and on this fungi and on this insect or what? They don't look at any of that. They have no idea. And so they now we're learning that trees that in a forest, they have a natural, some of them have a natural immunity to insects and disease, any particular insect and disease. So what will happen is all the trees don't die when there's an insect outbreak. Some of them survive, and then they replicate. And so they reforest that area with resistant trees. Well, of course, if you go out and whack all the trees, you don't know which ones are genetically resistant and which ones aren't. You have no idea. So you're cutting down all the trees, including the ones that probably would have survived. So it's just enormously crude, and it doesn't work. None of these things cure the disease. None of them stop the diseases from happening if they happen. And the forests survive. They come back. That's nature. That's the way things work.
Also, a lot of the, well, there's two directions I want to go. One of them is a lot of the forests that are that are hit by insects or various infestation in various diseases were already cut, and they were replanted as not the mosaic that a natural forest is. And I love the phrase, I love the phrase, nature hates a monocrop. And sometimes it seems to me, let me know if this is wrong. Sometimes it seems to me that these insect infestations are ways of nature attempting to destroy, for example, a Doug fir monocrop to help it become the Doug fir, Western red cedar, alder, you know, various mixed forests that it was before it got logged. Is that accurate enough?
Well, yeah. I mean, you think about it, these ecosystems evolved, the insects and the diseases, as well as the trees and everything else, evolved together over endless time. So they're used to each other. And then you stick some exotic, weird crop tree in there, and they're not used to, they're not even, a lot of them are hybrid or whatever trees. They're not even really natural trees. And so you have a bunch of them there that are not naturally immune anyway. And then you stick them a whole bunch of them together, and it's just asking for an epidemic. And that's exactly what you get. And the same with fire. It's the research has shown that these mono plantations burn hotter and more often and more devastatingly than natural forests. And of course, in terms of biodiversity, we know that plantations are a biological wasteland, whereas natural forests are infinitely more diverse. And the same with carbon storage. I mean, they're still planting trees on, I think, the industrial forests. A lot of those in the South, East and the Northwest are plantations. They don't do it in the Northeast and the upper Midwest because it isn't really economically worth it. But still, a large proportion of these so-called, they're not even forests. Plantation is not a forest. It's just, it's like saying a cornfield is a prairie. It's just idiotic. So yes, plantations make it. And people don't know this, though. That's another thing. When I talk to people and I talk about clear cutting or whatever, and they go, oh, that's terrible. And they go, don't they at least replant? Which seems totally reasonable. And I say, let's hope not, because it's going to create this. It's not going to be a forest anymore. And they go, oh, I didn't realize that. That's because of all the propaganda that makes it. And even today, as we know, these companies will, you know, these polluting companies say, oh, well, for everything we ruin, we're going to plant a million trees or whatever. And people go, yeah, isn't that great? So this mythology is, we've had 100 years of forestry mythology that people have heard over and over and over and over again, all the time because we've got all the money of the forest industry and these agencies, which are all in cahoots with the forest, and that includes state agencies, all the state forestry agencies are the same way, Bureau of Land Management. They've created this mythology, and all of these things get weaved into the mythology, and you have to deprogram people so they realize that, wow, I've really been bamboozled by these guys. Another excuse is water quality. In Massachusetts, they do clear cutting and patch cutting and other stuff around the Quabbin Reservoir, which is this 25,000 acre reservoir, which is the size of Jackson Lake in Grand Teton National Park. So that's pretty big. And that supplies about 2.5 million people's water in the Boston metro area. And it was created in the 1930s, and they bought about 80,000 acres of land around the reservoir because they said, oh, having trees there in a forest will prevent soil erosion. It'll clean the water and whatever, which was true. The foresters came up with the idea that, oh yeah, but those trees are going to fall down eventually, and some will get blown down, some will get insects and disease, and when they do, that's going to expose the soil to erosion. So what we need to do is cut them down so they don't get old and fall down, and then young ones will grow up and you'll have all this brush and scrub that will prevent erosion. And so and their excuse is, well, they say, well, the water quality of the Quabbin Reservoir is really high, it stayed high, so obviously this is good for water quality. And this is like the correlation is not causation thing going on here, because they have no proof that the water quality wouldn't be better if they weren't doing this logging. And of course, there's plenty of science that shows that logging around water bodies increases erosion and runoff. Yet this idea, actually, they're replicating this now in New Jersey and in New York and other places. They think this sounds like a great idea, is to cut the trees. They don't cut them all at once, but they cut these patches and so forth. So the forest will never get old. They want these mid-age forests because supposedly it won't fall down. So logging is good for water quality, another checkoff on the list of all the benefits of logging.
Well, there's another one in California that's being pushed, which is that reservoirs are not high enough because of drought. And so we all know that trees are water hogs who suck up lots of water. So what they want to do, this has actually been proposed in California,
right?
Hasn't been done yet, I think, is they want to cut all the trees on the hillsides above the reservoirs so there will be more runoff into the reservoir.
And these cockamamie things, it's been pointed out that these are totally, all this stuff for that matter, they're uncontrolled experiments. If you really set up a legitimate experiment from scratch, you would never do anything like this because there's no control. So you've got these reservoirs and whatever. They don't have any reservoirs where it's wilderness all around it. And over decades and decades and decades, they compare one of the ones where they cut the trees to a wilderness reservoir and take a look at water quality and water runoff and so forth. They don't do that. They just have these ideas and they just go ahead and do it. And it's interesting, one of the places where they were clear cutting around a reservoir was Bull Run in Oregon, which is the water supply for Portland, I believe, partly the water supply. And this was a old growth, surrounded by old growth forest in, Willamette National Forest, one of the national forests, Mount Hood, maybe. And this was these beautiful old growth forests, and the Forest Service was going in there and they started clear cutting around this reservoir. And guess what? The water quality degraded, and it got worse and worse. And of course, it was ugly, it looked horrible, and people finally just said, hey, this is our water supply. You need to stop doing this. And there were lawsuits and so forth. And finally, they were forced to stop logging. So there's a real life example where it did trash the water supply. Yet they don't seem to learn any of the lessons of these things because they don't want to. You know, it's the old thing of if a guy's salary depends on it, it's hard to get him to change his mind.
So there's something I've always wondered. I don't know if you know the answer to this, but a friend of mine who is normally extremely reliable on facts told me that the real death knell for the American chestnut in the Midwest was not so much the chestnut blight, but it was the loggers who went through afterwards and cut the trees who were resistant to it, saying to the people, look, those trees are going to die, doing salvage logging back then. That yep. After the blight went through, there was a wave of loggers going to all sorts of people saying, look, you got to cut them down now or they're going to die. And is that your understanding of that too?
Well, you know, I have not looked into that situation deeply, although actually what you're talking about is exactly what I think happened based on what we're seeing with other insects and diseases. And knowing now that a proportion of trees, as far as we can see, all of them, there's a proportion that are resistant. So there probably were resistant chestnuts. And yes, they just went through with a flurry, and they were super valuable, of course, as timber. So, if, you know, what a good excuse to go and whack all the chestnuts. And once there aren't any chestnuts around, there's no seed source to reseed the trees or to although they resprout. So there are places in New England where they will resprout. But most of them get disease and don't reach maturity. But, you know, a good example of this is the woolly adelgid is a little bug that infests hemlocks, eastern hemlocks. And they're an invasive species. They came from Asia, I believe. And the foresters said, oh, my God, they're going to just wipe out all the hemlocks. The hemlocks might even go extinct. You know, this is just a total disaster. And what's really bad is we really should cut them all down, but hemlocks are not worth very much as timber. So what are we going to do? We're going to have all these dying and diseased hemlocks are all going to fall over and die, and we can't cut them down to save the forest. Well, guess what's happening? A lot of hemlocks are not dying of woolly adelgid. It has not been a holocaust for hemlock. And my guess, and sure, a lot of them have died, but a lot have not. And my guess is that's exactly what would have been the case with the chestnut if they had not done what they did. So there may be scientific work that's been done on this that I haven't read yet, but I think that's probably totally right, is that that's what happened.
So we have a while left. We have maybe 14, 15 minutes. So we don't need to wind down quite yet. But first off, are there other excuses? Oh, what about the global warming excuse?
That's the one, the next one. And I think that's the most
stupid.
That's sort of the latest one. And in a lot of ways, it's the most dishonest one, too, because they've flipped it around. We know that cutting trees releases almost all the carbon in the tree. You're lucky if maybe 20 or 30% ends up in some, you know, in the house or something. And then the house probably gets torn down in 50 or 60 years. But they have flipped it around so that now they're saying actually logging is good for climate change. And they have a number of reasons why they claim that. One is, of course, you've no doubt heard about is resilience. It increases the resilience of the forest. And that supposedly, what it means is that natural forests supposedly are going to blow down and they don't have enough different kinds of age classes and they don't have enough different species. And so you got to go in and you got to diversify that forest, which means cutting a bunch of the trees, and then that becomes more resilient so it can resist climate change. There's no evidence that that's really true. That's just a made-up thing, but it sounds good. I mean, resilience is important for climate change. The idea that logging increases resilience is totally bogus, but they claim that. Related to that is adaptation. And people have probably heard these stories about, oh my God, the climate is shifting north, so we've got all these species that are going to be marooned and won't be able to shift with the climate. So we need assisted management. Assisted migration of species. So we need to start moving and planting trees from the south further north, which will be naturally able to deal with climate change. That's totally, you know, aspirational based on virtually no real data or experiments or anything. That's just made up too. Another one is, which is sort of getting pushed back, is that when you cut down a forest, that, you know, old trees don't sequester and store carbon as fast as young, thrifty trees do because they're growing really fast. So cutting down a forest actually improves carbon sequestration or the absorption of carbon, and that's good for climate. But the problem is that a bunch of small trees don't accumulate as much carbon as a few big trees. Also, when you cut the forest down, you're freeing up most of the carbon that's been stored there all that time. So it would take, you know, it takes decades and decades, if not centuries, to reabsorb the carbon that you release when you cut the forest down. So that's another one. Another one is, I think I mentioned, is that one way you do it is when you cut the forest down, the wood's going to go into wood products like houses, and now they have mass timber, which is like a basically glorified plywood, and we could build skyscrapers out of wood. And so we're going to lock up all this carbon in these long-lived wood buildings and other stuff, and then the trees will, in the meantime, the forest will grow back and reabsorb carbon. So it's not only net neutral, it's a net positive carbon flux. But the reality is all the numbers are cooked, and there's no evidence that any of that is true. And again, we know that cutting down forests releases most of the carbon. Another one that I mentioned is the whole biomass thing, the burning forests. Even though a lot of people have caught on to this, as we know, they're clear cutting huge areas in the southeastern U.S., turning them into wood pellets and shipping them over to England to be burned for electricity in giant plants, electrical plants. And this is because of this bogus numbering and number system that they came up with in the Kyoto Accords. They can count that as net neutral in terms of climate, in terms of emissions of carbon dioxide and whatever. So here they're trashing the forests here. They ship them over there. They burn them. All this stuff, dirtier than coal, is being spewed out. Yet that's supposedly carbon neutral. And there's a whole mythology that's built up to keep this thing going. And then actually the last thing I should talk, or maybe not the last, but one thing I don't want to forget is the illusion of preservation, which we mentioned, which is, sure, it would be nice. People may have heard about the 30 by 30 concept, which is that scientists in the UN and IUCN have said that we need, if we want to save biodiversity from huge losses, if we want to help to head off catastrophic climate change, we need to save at least 30% of the planet in a natural condition without any major industrial incursions or anything by 2030, which is and right now only about 12 or 13% or something like that is now fully protected. In the US, it's about the same. It's about 13%. So there's a lot of talk about this, but there's nothing going on to get toward that goal. I don't see anything. That there's a bunch of bogus stuff where they claim, they'll say, oh yeah, working forests that aren't turned into a Walmart, that's part of the 30 by 30, even though they're logging and so forth. But one of the arguments is, well, you know, maybe that's not such a good idea, because say we in Massachusetts, we create these reserves and in wild lands where we don't cut trees. Well, people in Massachusetts use toilet paper. They live in wooden houses. They use packaging. Where is that going to come from? Well, it's probably going to come from the Amazon rainforest. And that's going to be even worse for climate change. And plus, we do a really great job of managing our forests as opposed to those primitive third world countries. So we're better off. You know, it sure would be nice to have some forest left alone in the U.S., but really we can't afford to do that. And the other part of it is that they claim that that demand for wood is going to increase by 50% over in the coming few decades, by 2060, I believe. So we got to meet the demand. What are we going to do? And of course, there's never any talk about reducing demand and reducing waste and increasing recycling and reuse. But this argument has been, I've seen people who are well-meaning people be fooled by this argument, because they feel like, well, gee, I don't want to destroy the rainforest and I do use wood. So what can we do?
And I just want to point out really quickly that the forests of the American Southeast are being destroyed at a faster rate than the Amazon.
Yes. Yep. Yep. And they just don't, of course, they don't talk about that. They just conveniently talk about whatever works. It's all just a shell game to them. And the shocking thing to me, and we're dealing with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts right now, they're talking about a forest and climate plan and carbon and all those things, trying to reduce emissions and so forth. Yet there's no talk about reducing demand, which we could certainly do, easily reduce demand for wood products. There's no talk about any serious expansion of reserves and parks and preserves. It's basically all talk. And it's not just government. It's not just the industry. Conservation groups in general, what are they doing in terms of protecting forests globally? What are they doing? I don't see it. I don't see in the U.S. there's no, you know, we've got this talk about, you know, the U.S. Forest Service and BLM have done an inventory of old growth and mature forests on public lands. And it's certainly not perfect, but they've come up with around 62% of national forest and BLM lands are old growth or mature forests. And yet they continue to cut old growth in mature forests like crazy. And they've backed off a little bit on old growth, but they still are cutting old growth forests. The conservation movement is sort of, you know, mildly pushing back on this, but there's no serious effort to stop that. We should be ending logging on all public lands. It's crazy that when you've got a climate crisis, you got a biodiversity crisis, people need places, green places to go, and we're still logging our public lands. Even if we stopped logging on all the public lands, we still wouldn't reach 30 by 30. That alone wouldn't do it. It would get us close. It's like there's no sense that this is an emergency, even though it's an emergency. And we need to ramp. This is an all hands on deck situation. We need to ramp up our protection of forests. And that's why I a while back decided I'm going to focus on forest preservation and not try to improve management, because it's just like a Sisyphusian pushing the rock up the hill. It's you just never win. They have too much money, too much clout. But if we just get them off the public lands, turn them into parks and preserve and wilderness, then they're gone. Sure, then they'll start to trash private lands, but that's another battle we can, at least we'll have something to work with if we have a lot of protected public lands.
So we're running out of time in more ways than one, and a couple of things. One of them is that, the Forest Service was set up really to protect the lands from the depredations of the timber industry,
mm-hmm.
and at that it succeeded for quite a while, but it is now completely failing.
Right.
Okay, that's one thing. Second thing is, if somebody had lied to you as many times as the Forest Service has lied to the public about the reasons for logging, would you buy a used car from them? And I would not buy a used car from someone who had sold me, 25 lemons by now?
Yeah.
And then I'm going to say the third thing, and then you can take it wherever you want for like the last minute. And the third thing is that this is a measure of how far backwards I think the environmental movement has gone in the past 30 years, in that in the mid-90s, there was a serious movement for zero cut on public lands.
Yeah.
And that movement has, I don't want to say disappeared because you're talking about it, but it has diminished. I think you and I would agree with that. And so can you talk about the importance, as you just were, of revivifying the zero cut on public lands movement?
Well, I think the thing to the way to look at it is, if you started all over again with a map and you had these public lands on the map, and you were asked, what are we going to do with these lands? I think most people would probably say, let's make them national parks and preserves, and let's keep them intact. They wouldn't say, yeah, let's cut all the trees down. So we need to just have a totally clean slate the way we think about these lands. And in the era of climate change and biodiversity loss or whatever, it's crazy to be cutting down trees on public lands. I mean, it's not necessary. I think politically, it's impossible to go from 0 to 100% immediately. But I think that ought to be our goal in the long run, number one. But number two, in the short run, that's why we're proposing, our organization is proposing 100 new national parks that would mainly come from public lands that are now being logged and grazed and whatever. That would up the percentage of protected lands to 20%, which still isn't 30%, but that in one big jump. And the thing about that is that people love national parks, and it's a positive. I think part of the problem with the zero cut is it was a negative thing. Let's stop cutting, even though it would be a good thing. It sounds negative. It sounds like you're anti. Whereas we can be pro national park, and we can say, look, the reason we need them, among other things, is because they're trashing these lands. But this is a solution to that. This is a positive solution, and you're going to get something from this. You, the public, you're going to be giving yourselves a gift of these beautiful new national parks that everyone can enjoy, including the wildlife as well as people. It'll help climate change. It'll help biodiversity loss. And we can do this right now. And in fact, we probably would save money, because all of these, we're spending billions of dollars subsidizing logging and grazing. And if we did that, if we took, if we tripled the size of the National Park Service to about 160, 170 million acres, increasing it by that much to about 240 million acres, that would be a stake in the heart of the industrial forest and grazing paradigm. And all of a sudden people would go, well, why not this area? Why not that area? Why would we keep logging there? Right now we have no, it's like zero or nothing is what we've got right now. And I think the conservation movement has been beaten down and beaten politically so long, they just can't see. They don't believe we can do great things and bold things anymore, so they don't even try. And you're never going to get it if you don't propose it and you don't go for it. And I think the public would be on our side if we really got serious about large scale protection. And everyone knows we don't have time to waste. We got no time. We're behind in this.
Well, Thank you so much for that. I really agree with everything you're saying. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Michael Kellett. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.